From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, Rhetoric, Oratory, and Poetry in Classical Greek Culture. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are two scholars in residence at the National Humanities Center, Shalom Perlman of Tel Aviv University and Victor Matthews of the University of Guelph. First on this edition of Soundings, a discussion with Shalom Perlman about the life and work of Isocrates, an orator important to both politics and education in 4th century Athens. Following that, a conversation with Victor Matthews about the poet Antimachus, who is noteworthy in classical Greek literary history. Here is Shalom Perlman.
Isocrates was one of the greatest, probably, orators of Athens, of democratic classical Athens. He lived in the 4th century, though he was born in the 5th, even before the Peloponnesian War, lived to a very old age, and died, so the story goes, on the day after the famous and decisive Battle of Chaeronea, in which Philip conquered or defeated the Athenians and their allies, and practically became the master of Greece. Greek democracy, or Athenian democracy for that matter, and may I, in a parenthesis, say something which may be of importance as well. Democracy was not a very popular regime in antiquity either.
This is a kind of an irony. We look back to the Greeks and thank them for our notions of democracy.
That's right. Without the Greeks, we probably wouldn't have had the notions of democracy, and we wouldn't have had the word even. But on the other hand, in the modern world, we should remember as well that democracies in Greece were few and far between. And therefore, Athens stands out as that interesting and unique Greek city because it was democratic, and it was really democratic more in the 4th century probably than in the 5th. But that is in parentheses, as we said. Now the differences. Greek democracy was first and foremost a direct democracy in which everybody could and should have probably participated. It was not a representative democracy. People took part in the assembly. The assembly of the people was the final or the highest body.
Well, let's talk about Isocrates now, Shalom Perlman. You said at the outset of our conversation that he was an orator. What does that mean? We have our notions of high school oratory contests. We have our notions of political television commercials. And we have our notions of what, to put a sort of negative spin on it, bombast and pretense and all of that when we talk about oratory. Untangle that for me with respect to your man, Isocrates.
Well, you owe a lot of all these you mentioned to Isocrates, as a matter of fact. And let me try and do it in two ways or in two things. I'll try to deal with the bombast and with the pejorative meaning of oratory first.
Fair enough.
The 4th century in which Isocrates actually was active, during which time he was really active. The 4th century is the century of oratory and philosophy. And the two figures which stand out, of course, in the 4th century are Plato, on one hand, the philosopher, and Isocrates. Isocrates was the first to found his school, and what it was perhaps a little bit later. And about 5 years or so later, Plato founded his academy. The two schools were probably in competition during the 4th century.
Competition in the sense of what? Having students?
Competition having not of having students, but competition in with regard to what they were teaching, whether this was the thing to teach, the best thing to teach to make a man better.
How to live one's life.
How to live one's life, how to serve one's country, and so on and so forth. The two were in competition in this regard, Plato's predominance later on is quite obvious and quite clear. And Plato was very, very hard on rhetoric. Plato wanted what he regarded as episteme, or what he called episteme, which means exact knowledge of whatever you want to know. And a rhetoric is a sort of a sham way to persuade people of whatever you want.
Well, we're back to television commercials.
Exactly. That's what why I said this is the first point. Whereas Isocrates, although he speaks of what he is teaching also as philosophy, he calls it philosophia, which is probably legitimate because, after all, it's the love of knowledge. But for him, the crucial, again, term is doxa. And doxa really means a well-founded opinion. In other words, Isocrates says, we can never reach the point of exact full knowledge, and therefore doxa is enough. Because here comes the second thing which we should say in answer to your first or to your question before that, and that is that Isocrates saw in speech and speech not only that someone speaks and knows the alphabet, but in speech as a form and in the contents of that speech something which distinguishes man from everybody else on one hand, or not everybody, but everything else on one hand, and which really is creating or is causing logical and well-structured thought.
All right, but now let me stop you on that and sort of argue with you, Shalom Perlman. Simply because an individual is capable of speech and therefore of, well, capable of reasoning and along with that speech, that doesn't necessarily make the opinion valid. It doesn't necessarily, condone it or put a social imprimatur on one's behavior. Am I, again, being unfair to Isocrates?
Yes, because Isocrates would have argued that speech or is of very great importance, but it is perhaps only the basis or the most important ingredient in what is the education of a good citizen. And he undoubtedly taught also some other things in his school. Out of school came, and he says himself so, came not only orators, but he says teachers and historians and other people, obviously politicians. He would have liked, we know of, for example, two at least important generals in the 4th century, about two or three historians in the 4th century who were students in Isocrates' school. So that it was not a one-sided education towards oratory and rhetoric only. It was what we would probably call, and what has been called by many scholars, liberal education.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of assumptions would Isocrates have been making about this leadership that he wants to condone and set aside, this professional class of people, individuals who are capable of leading a society? Is he talking about their training? Is he talking about human nature? Let's figure that mixture out.
I think that he is talking first and foremost about training.
Mm-hmm.
And
nature and nurture are
with nature and nurture are of greatest importance. Uh-huh. Of greatest importance. And when he says that who will be the good orator, he says first of all one who has the inclination to it. Mm-hmm. One who is naturally constituted so that he will be a good orator. And then he says, of course, practice and teaching. Yes, but undoubtedly these are, there must be the natural basis. Mm-hmm. But after the natural basis, there is teaching and there is training. And one of the things which, although he does not say it, I expect he would have wanted to see, would have been his students or his pupils taking part in that political life and being those political leaders.
Mm-hmm. Shalom Perlman, we've been talking about your investigations at the Humanities Center into Isocrates, a 4th century rhetorician. Let's conclude our conversation. What do you find appealing about this man? Why, as a scholar, do you want to devote so much time and energy to him?
One, I think that it is about time to really see what the controversy between Isocrates and the and Plato or the philosophical schools and so on comes to.
Uh-huh.
Secondly, I think that not only Isocrates' political views, but Isocrates' views on education, on oratory, on rhetoric, on speech and thought, on writing speeches and not always delivering them, are very important to understand not only Athenian democracy, but also development of education, the development, for example, of written culture, as not opposed, but as compared with oral culture.
Mm-hmm.
These are some of the very important things which interest me. And it is also perhaps a good pretext to, as we have done here, go a little bit more in depth and see the 4th century, also from this point of view.
Shalom Perlman is a professor of classics at Tel Aviv University. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Shalom Perlman is at work on a forthcoming study of the life and work of Isocrates, a 4th century Athenian orator and rhetorician. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Classical Greek Culture continues now with a discussion featuring another scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center. Victor Matthews teaches at the University of Guelph in Canada. During his fellowship year at the center, Victor Matthews is at work on a forthcoming study of the 4th century Athenian poet Antimachus, who is noteworthy not only for his own work, but also as one of the earliest editors of the epic poetry of Homer. Here is Victor Matthews.
Well, Antimachus is a poet who is active, say, around 400 BC. His approximate dates would be about 440, maybe down to 370. He's coming then at the very end of the archaic classical tradition of epic poetry, which has been more or less continuous, say, since the time of the Homeric poems around 750 BC. The other thing about Antimachus, you see, is that he's writing about 100 years before the Hellenistic poets,
mm-hmm.
people like Callimachus and Apollonius of Rhodes. And in many features, really, he anticipates the sort of things that they do with epic poetry.
What kinds of things did he write about? When we talk, when we use a term like epic poetry, what have you got in mind?
Yeah, well, the particular theme that he chose to write about was the story of the seven against Thebes.
Hmm.
It's a Thebaid, in other words, a long epic poem in at least six books dealing with the expedition of the seven against Thebes. There had been an earlier epic, one of the so-called cyclic epics called the Thebaid, which would be dating probably from the 7th or 6th century. Very, very little remains of that. But one thing is that all Greek epic poetry, including Antimachus and including the Hellenistic poets, has to be seen against sort of the backdrop of Homer. It's all sort of ultimately derivative or an imitation of Homer.
Why is Homer so important, therefore?
Well, one reason I think that so little of earlier poetry is left, apart from Homer,
mm-hmm.
was that very early on, Homer was recognized as the best. And the Alexandrian poets in the Hellenistic Age, the scholars there, did draw up canons or sort of tables ranking early poets. And Homer, of course, is always number one in epic poetry. Antimachus, in fact, in some of the canons is ranked number two,
mm-hmm.
After Homer. But Homer treated, of course, the Trojan War in the Iliad, and then, of course, the story of Odysseus in the Odyssey. And to a very large extent, you know, was seen in early Greek history more or less as the Bible of the Greeks, the educator of the Greeks. And even in the late 5th century, say in the time of Antimachus, there are people around who know Homer by heart.
Mm-hmm. What does Antimachus do to Homer? He acts as what? He modifies him? He's also a conduit passing what conceptions of Homeric or epic poetry on to subsequent poets?
Well, the sort of techniques that Antimachus uses are the same sort of techniques as, say, Callimachus and Apollonius use in the Hellenistic Age. Antimachus knows Homer inside out. So he will borrow sometimes phrases from Homer. And the ingenuity really lies in what he does with these.
Again, be specific mm-hmm. for me. Give me a couple of examples.
Well, there are some really very, very interesting examples. There are three fragments of Antimachus, which are preserved by the late writer Porphyrius, who accuses Antimachus of stealing from Homer and changing them for the worse. And whenever you examine these fragments, you can see it's not really just a case of a mediocre poet lifting lines lock, stock, and barrel from Homer and making a slight change in the line. Instead, one of those fragments in particular shows, I think, a very clever use of allusive technique
mm-hmm.
By Antimachus. And this is because the line he's accused of stealing, it's a line about Diomedes, one of the Greeks at Troy. And the line as it stands in Homer is one of the sort of stock type lines. It's a formulaic line. Ton dapame bomenos prosophe krateros Diomedes.
Tell me what that means.
That means, in answer to him, mighty Diomedes said. Now, Antimachus, in borrowing this line, changes the one word in it, changes the adjective krateros, meaning mighty,
mm-hmm.
to the adjective kreon, which again means something very similar, strong, mighty, ruler. And The only difference it makes to the line is that the fourth foot of the line becomes a sponde instead mm-hmm. of a dactyl.
Now, let me stop you, Vic Matthews. Mm-hmm. I'm going to accuse you. I'm going to pick a fight here with you. Are we talking about the number of angels who dance on the head of a pin? Is this just a tiny little literary squabble that you're describing? Why is this important?
Well, I'll show you what happens, in fact, in this particular change. He substitutes the adjective crayon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the previous word, of course, krateros, it's almost the stock epithet of Diomedes in the Iliad. It's used of him, I think, something like 20 times,
mm-hmm.
whereas it only occurs of 13 other people, once each, in the Iliad. The word crayon is used frequently of Agamemnon mm-hmm. in the Iliad. And in fact, there are five lines which are repetitions of the same line, which begin, ton dapame promenos prosophe creon. And that's the same then as the Antimachus line, except that the subject at the end of the line is not Diomedes, it's Agamemnon. So I would suggest that what Antimachus was doing by changing krateros to creon
mm-hmm.
is that he wants to make us think of Diomedes in the role of Agamemnon.
Why would he do this? Why is that important?
Well, that's it's a really good question. And
this is part of what you're up to in these commentaries, I take it.
That's right. And I would suggest there that there is a story which is not told by Homer
uh-huh.
that whenever Diomedes came back from Troy, he found that his wife had become an adulteress. She had a lover. And they plotted against him,
mm-hmm.
and he had to take to his heels and flee to Italy, where he was killed.
And all of this you extrapolate from the change of one small mm-hmm. adjective.
Yeah.
All right.
I think the circumstances fit the case really just too neatly.
Mm-hmm.
There's also another very interesting thing. I said that Homer didn't know that story of Diomedes and his wife. Homer, though, does talk about Diomedes and his wife. The reason for the wife committing adultery in the other story was that this was the revenge of Aphrodite
uh-huh.
after being wounded by Diomedes at Troy. Now, Homer does tell us about Aphrodite being wounded by Diomedes, and after she's wounded, she goes back up to Olympus, and she's consoled there by her mother, Dione. And Dione talks to her and gives a warning, you know, to people who fight against immortal gods, and says, Diomedes better look out that he doesn't fight anyone stronger than you. Otherwise, he'll not come back home from the war.
Mm-hmm.
His children won't sit around his knees calling him daddy. One thing I think, if I'm right about this fragment, it probably doesn't belong to the epic poem.
Hmm.
It belongs to his elegy poem. His elegy poem was called the Lyde, and apparently was written after the death of his wife, where he sort of consoled himself by writing a poem dealing with the misfortunes of famous people in mythology. And a good number of these misfortunes have to do with unhappy love stories.
Well, he's also telling us something about himself, which is intensely personal.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Is that right?
And it's very unusual uh-huh. for a poet like him.
Uh-huh.
Another interesting thing, of course, is the fact that Antimachus is said to have been admired by Plato. And I think a number of places you can see that perhaps this admiration was because of the moral tone in Antimachus.
Mm-hmm. Now, wait, you say that Plato admired Antimachus. Just parenthetically, I thought Plato didn't like the poets. He was he wanted to throw them out of the Republic.
Well, what he wanted of poets is that the poets should give, you know, good moral messages. He envisions sort of state poets
mm-hmm.
Sort of writing the sort of poetry that would be for the good of the state.
Mm-hmm. Pushing what, an ideological line that he approved of?
Well, sort of a moral line. What he doesn't like about Homer, you know, are the various stories about deities getting up to all sorts of immorality,
mm-hmm.
you know, seducing nymphs right and left, and
mm-hmm.
things of this sort.
He didn't approve?
No. And there's another fragment of Antimachus where I think you can see that Antimachus sort of bowdlerized the normal tradition about the parentage of the horse Arion in order to give sort of a cleaner, more moral version,
mm-hmm.
one which doesn't show the god Poseidon in such a bad light
mm-hmm.
As the normal version.
Vic Matthews, we're talking about your investigations into a Greek poet named Antimachus. You come to the Humanities Center from the University of Guelph. Let's conclude our conversation. Tell me why you think it's important that you as a specialist, and I hope you know you are looking in some fashion at a general audience, why should people know about this poet? What is it possible for you to speculate on how he comes to us in the 1980s, or is he, again, the lot of an arcane handful of specialists?
Well, I think it's significant in that it helps us to see the continuity in Greek epic poetry
mm-hmm.
from Homer through the Hellenistic period,
mm-hmm.
that things just don't come to a stop in the 5th century and are suddenly flowering again after 300 BC. That a person, say, like Panyasis a little earlier, and then Antimachus, are responsible for sort of pointing the poetry in a different direction. It's no longer just no good enough to write sort of stock epic verse. You have to do so in a very learned way.
Mm-hmm. So the poetry's becoming what, more sophisticated,
that's
is
right.
it? As it gets
yes.
away from this oral mm-hmm. tradition and into a written one.
Yeah, it's people really writing for people like themselves. They're
uh-huh.
writing for a cognoscenti.
Uh-huh. The beginnings of graduate school.
In a way, yeah. I think you know you could say that subsequent Greek epic poetry is largely a series of footnotes to Homer.
Mm-hmm. Victor Matthews is a professor of classics at the University of Guelph in Canada. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Victor Matthews is at work on a series of commentaries on the 4th century Athenian poet Antimachus. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Classical Greek Rhetoric, Oratory, and Poetry, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, the first in a series of conversations about American literary themes, including realism and naturalism in the 19th and 20th centuries, and hymnody and poetry in the 19th century. My guests will include Mary DeYoung of Pennsylvania State University and Lee Mitchell of Princeton University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for discussions about oratory and poetry in classical Greek culture. Wayne's guests are scholars from Tel Aviv University and the University of Guelph in Canada. The lives and works of Isocrates, the rhetorician, and Antimachus, the poet. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.